Unit 14.
Text 1. That astounding creator, Nature, by Jean-Georges. A bird that eats feathers, a mammal that never drinks, a fish that grows a fishing line, and a worm on its head to catch other fish. Creatures in a nightmare. No, they are very much with us as co-inhabitants of this earth. Nature has fashioned most animals to fit the many faces of the land. Moose to marshes, squirrels to trees, camels to deserts, frogs to lily pads. Give nature an environment or situation, and she will evolve a creature, adapting a toe here, an eye there, until the being fits the niche. As a result of this hammering and fitting, however, some really unbelievable creatures circle the sun with us. One summer in Maine, I saw a sleek mother horned grebe herding her three bobbing young to supper among the green pickerel weed. Suddenly, I noticed through my binoculars that she was feeding her babies quantities of feathers from a deserted duck's nest. As she stuffed the dry feathers into the gaping mouths, she made two or three pokes to get each one down. Finally, she worked a dozen or so down her own throat. Then, sailing low on the water, she vanished contentedly among the plants. I later learned that 60% of the grebe's diet is feathers. When I asked why, a biologist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service answered, "Because nature finds a use for everything. Feathers seem to act as a strainer to prevent fish bones from entering and damaging the intestines." Australia has many strange beasts, one of the oddest of which is the koala. Perfectly adapted to one specific tree, the eucalyptus, this living teddy bear does not need anything else, not even a drink. The moisture in the leaves is just right for the koala, making it the only land animal that doesn't need water to supplement its food. The creature with the fishing line on its head was created for the dark canyons of the sea. Here the food is so scarce that the deep-sea fish, which preys on smaller fish, grew a line, and an appendage on the end that wiggles like a worm. This catches the attention of the occasional passerby. A fish approaches the bait, and the toothy angler swells up and swallows him. The gigantic ocean bottom creates other problems. A male anglerfish could swim for years without meeting a female of his own species. Nature's solution to this problem is for the female to carry a dwarfed husband tightly fused to her body. Marine biologists believe that this nuptial begins when the eggs first hatch, and there are many fry of both sexes. A male then grabs hold of a female with his mouth and hangs on until he has literally become a part of her. His mouth becomes fused to her stomach, and for the rest of his life the male remains attached to his mate, marking the most amazing union on earth. Sound has shaped the bodies of many beasts. Noise tapped away at the bullfrog until his ears became bigger than his eyes. Now he hears so well that at the slightest sound of danger he quickly plops to safety under a sunken leaf. The rabbit has long ears to hear the quiet whoosh of the owl's wings, while the grasshopper's ears are on the base of his abdomen, the lowest point of his body, where he can detect the tread of a crow's foot or the stealthy approach of a shrew. Sometimes food will determine an animal's appearance. Earthworms have shaped the woodcock, a snipe-like bird of the forest floor. This creature has a long, narrow bill that looks like a pencil and fits neatly into the burrows of the worms. But the bill has its disadvantages. With it buried deep in a wormhole, the woodcock is vulnerable to attack from above. To counteract this danger, the woodcock has eyes near the top of his head. This singular device permits him to scan the trees for danger, even when his beak is buried. A successful arrangement for longevity, but it certainly creates an odd-looking creature. The need to catch elusive prey has evolved some staggering biological tricks. The sea anemone, a flower-like animal of the tide mark, is usually riveted to one spot, yet it feeds on darting fish. The diabolically clever trap was necessary to catch them, so the anemone developed tentacles with bombs in the end of each. When a fish forages into these tentacles, the end shoot a thin thread into the fish's body. The thread in turn explodes a paralyzing poison. The stunned fish is hauled in by the tentacles and shoved into the anemone's gullet. Nature seems to have gone all out in creating preposterous gadgets for self-defense. The jacana, a bird of the American tropics, for instance, is endowed with spurs which unfold like a switchblade at the bend of the bird's wing, and with which he can slash his enemies to shreds. Lizards are professionals in the art of warding off attack. The two-headed skink, whose tail is shaped like his head, confuses his enemy. A hawk, upon attacking this fellow, anticipates that he will run in the direction of the lifted head and makes allowance for the movement. However, the bird usually strikes nothing, for he is aiming at the tail. The real head took off the other way. In order to travel in a hostile world, the Portuguese man of war first mastered the art of floating. To do this, it evolved a purple bag and inflated it with gas from a special gland. As a crowning idea, it also grew a sail. Launched, the man of war can blow away from enemies or approach food by putting its sail up and down. When severely threatened, it forces the gas out of the float and submerges. There is hardly any environment, however hostile, that some creature has not mastered. Land is, of course, the nemesis of the fish. If they flop out on it, they die. If their ponds dry up, they are helpless. Given this situation, it was almost certain that some fish would evolve a way to beat it. And so there is a lungfish. It is an air breather and must come up to the surface every 20 minutes or so, otherwise it drowns. When the ponds of Africa dry up in the arid season, the lungfish wrap themselves in mud and wait it out, sometimes for years. When the rains finally return, they resume their water life. Just as nature adds things on creatures that need them, so she occasionally takes things away from those that don't. The adult mayfly, for example, has no mouth or stomach. Last year, by a northern New York lake, I found myself amid hundreds of thousands of these insects. I told the conservation officer whom I was with that I was glad they didn't bite. He replied that they have no mouths to bite with. An adult mayfly lives but one day, he explained, and that day is devoted entirely to pleasure. They do nothing but dance and mate all their short life, and so they do not need a mouth. With all this elaborate evolution, it is not surprising that some of nature's inventions got out of hand. In this category falls the speedometer of reindeer. A tendon snaps back and forth over a bone in the reindeer's foot, noisily tapping out the speed of his gait. Useless. And so is the nose on the stomach of the scorpion and the feather-like tongue of the toucan, a bird of Africa. But probably the most dumbfounding of nature's extraordinary creations is the horned toad of our southwest. A herpetologist once invited me to observe one of these lizards right after it had molted. In a sand-filled glass cage I saw a large male. Beside him lay his old skin. The herpetologist began to annoy the beast with mock attacks, and the old man of the desert with his vulnerable new suit became frightened. Suddenly his eyeballs reddened. A final fast lunge from my friend at the beast, and I froze in astonishment. A fine spray of blood shot from the lizard's eye, like fire from a dragon. The beast had struck back with a weapon so shocking that it terrifies even the fiercest enemy. Later I walked home, pondering the bizarre methods for survival with which evolution has endowed Earth's creatures, sometimes comical, sometimes pathetic. I knew the biologists were right. If any adaptation is possible, nature has tried it.
Text 2. When the Young Have It Good by Robert Ardrey. The African hunting dog, known in the early days as the Cape hunting dog, is perhaps the world's most successful predator, excluding only man. It is not a dog at all, not even a member of the family Canidae, but has four toes on his foot, ears like ping-pong paddles, and bears the scientific name Lycaon pictus. It looks like a dog, however, and not a very large one, since it weighs almost 40 pounds. Its success as a hunter had been based entirely on a capacity to outrun any animal in Africa, together with a superb coordination of its hunting pack. But despite its success, or because of it, the hunting dog is a rare animal today. Since the early times of settlement in the Cape, 300 years ago, its reputation has been so terrifying that men have hunted it, even poisoned it, as vermin. The hunting dog has terrified not only men, but other animals. I have watched Thompson's gazelle graze within 200 yards of a hungry cheetah, the fastest of land animals. But in 1966, when Elliot Elisaphone and I had the chance to photograph a large hunting dog pack for 3 days, dawn to dusk, no antelope approached close enough to be identified without binoculars. Within our view was perhaps 30 square miles of flat, open, treeless plain. Along the margins, animals grazed. Just once, 4 zebras strolled by at a distance of several hundred yards. Since they had the confidence, one must assume that the margin was sufficient for escape, but also the pack was sleeping. At that time, a study of one pack over a period of a few months was all that science had yet collected in the way of reliable observation. When I returned to the Serengeti 2 years later, however, Kruk and Schaller, as byproducts of their hyena and lion specialties, had collected more information on the entire predator community than science had ever possessed before. It is information which, although largely unpublished, I am permitted to use before this investigation closes. Now, in terms of adult-young relations of almost shocking amiability, I wish simply to describe one hunt. Schaller, by the summer of 1968, had followed 22 packs. He came by my cottage about 4 o'clock one afternoon, having spotted a pack which he judged would hunt about 5:30. By 4:30, he had found it, sleeping in the midst of a rolling area of plain, parched by the dry season, burned black by fire. We animal watched, waited, talked. There were 10 adults and 14 pups, well over half grown. Schaller had known the pack when the pups were born 6 months earlier, and there had been 16. They had lost only 2. It was an infant mortality rate so low as to be difficult to believe. Finally, 3 adults were stirring, nosing the others to their feet. All went to the pups. And now there was a rolling pell-mell of play, adults and pups together, and the strange twittering sound like a flock of sparrows that the dogs make when excited. "War dance," said Schaller, and like a ritual it was, for the dogs, when sufficiently excited, were all on their feet. The 3 leaders headed off, other adults behind them, then the pups, and last a disabled adult on 3 legs. It was precisely 5:30. Whether they had heard a factory whistle blow or Schaller earlier had given them instructions, I do not know. One of the most memorable sights in nature, however, is that of a pack strung out in single file almost a quarter of a mile long, headed into the late gray light with white-tipped tails upraised like beacons to make following easier. They trotted. The hunting dog, like the albatross, the elephant seal, and few other species, has no least fear of men, and one may drive beside the pack as if one were not there. We checked the Land Rover's speedometer, and they were doing 15 miles an hour. The pups kept the pace with ease, as did the adult on 3 legs. Now the leaders speeded up to a run. The speedometer read 25 miles an hour. Still, the pups and the 3-legged rear guard kept even. But now the leaders were putting on pressure and a gap was widening between adults and pups. Since game flee an area in which a pack is running, a common tactic is to approach a rise at high speed on the chance of surprising prey on the far side. Such speed for the 3 leaders with whom none could keep up was over 40 miles an hour. They outdistanced us, and by the time we reached the rise, the 3 had stopped. The others were catching up, and across the empty valley beyond, Thompson's gazelles were starting half a mile away. The word was being spread. Hunting dogs kill by surprise in 10 or 15 minutes or have a long search ahead through a forewarned world. Yet 85% of all hunts observed by Schaller have been successful, a record to stun a lion pride. The leaders were moving again in a new direction at a modest run. The whole torchlight parade of bouncing white tails reassembled behind them. Then the leaders were digging in at full run, and we could see three large warthogs ahead running at an angle to our left toward their hole. That monstrous machine, the Land Rover, will survive cross-country driving at such speed, but only with difficulty will its human occupants. I lost the warthogs. Within my view, however, the dogs were beginning one of their notable maneuvers. When prey curves in its flight, each dog in the file sets a separate course so that the pack is like narrowly set spokes in a wheel. They are not following. That is left to the leaders. They are setting courses of interception along the probable curve. But now there was no necessity. The warthogs had vanished, and we thought they had made it underground. But the leaders were struggling, for they had caught the last one by the hind legs, and all one could hear was the squealing of the warthog. "Poor pig," said Schaller. "Like a first-class nightmare, one is unlikely to forget a hunting dog kill, since it does not kill but eats its prey alive. Nothing has so contributed to hunting dog horror as the long-drawn manner of its prey's death. But in truth, the dog cannot kill. He is small, and his teeth are small, even for his size. He has 42, and they are designed for slicing, not killing. Only the cats have killing teeth, even the wolf. Taking caribou or moose will proceed as does the hunting dog. And yet, while nature may provide its explanations, the spectacle remains other than nice. I find it a subject for meditation that within my limited career of animal watching, the two images most horrid and sublime were separated by little over 60 seconds. By now the 100-pound warthog's viscera were torn open and he was finished, though still squealing. Then the 14 pups arrived, crowded into the living feast, and with their arrival every adult stepped back, none with more than a mouthful of meat. They were undoubtedly hungry, for their bellies were lean. Now and again they would string themselves out in hunting formation at some hint of further prey. But in the hour and 15 minutes that Schaller and I sat beside the kill, no adult took another mouthful of meat. The food was exclusively for the pups. We sat in the gathering darkness in the middle of a plain emptied of all living creatures by fear of these formidable little beasts, and we discussed what course of natural selection could have produced such inhibition favoring the young. Only a very high adult death rate could place such selective value on the successful raising of young to maturity. I speculated on disability. In the lion pride, all cubs eat last, and if kills are few or small, they starve. But the adult lion is very nearly invulnerable. The hunting dog, small and relatively fragile, may suffer a high casualty rate when attacking prey more formidable than warthogs. Schaller shook his head. "I think disease," he said. When it grew too dark to stay longer, we drove away. And 6 months later, Schaller wrote me that distemper had hit the pack, leaving only 9 survivors. When the young have it good, there is a reason somewhere. Listening in and speaking out. In the Laboratory with Agassiz, by Samuel H. Scudder. It was more than 15 years ago that I entered the laboratory of Professor Agassiz and told him I had enrolled my name in the scientific school as a student of natural history. He asked me a few questions about my object in coming, my past experience generally, the way in which I afterwards proposed to use the knowledge I might acquire, and finally, whether I wished to study any special branch. To the latter, I replied that while I wished to be well-grounded in all departments of zoology, I purposed to devote myself specially to insects. "When do you wish to begin?" he asked. "Now," I replied. This seemed to please him, and with an energetic, "Very well," he reached from a shelf a huge jar of specimens in yellow alcohol. "Take this fish," said he, "and look at it. We call it Hamulon. By and by I will ask you what you have seen." With that he left me, but in a moment returned with explicit instructions as to the care of the object entrusted to me. "No man is fit to be a naturalist," said he, "who does not know how to take care of specimens." I was to keep the fish before me in a tin tray and occasionally moisten the surface with alcohol from the jar, always taking care to replace the stoppers tightly. In 10 minutes I had seen all that could be seen in that fish, and started in search of the professor, who had, however, left the museum. Half an hour passed, an hour, another hour. The fish began to look loathsome. I turned it over and around, looked it in the face. Ghastly. From behind, beneath, above, sideways, at a three-quarters view. Just as ghastly. I was in despair. At an early hour, I concluded that lunch was necessary. So, with infinite relief, the fish was carefully placed in the jar, and for an hour I was free. On my return, I learned that Professor Agassiz had been at the museum, but had gone and would not return for several hours. My several students were too busy to be disturbed by continued conversation. Slowly I drew forth that hideous fish, and with a feeling of desperation, again looked at it. I might not use a magnifying glass. Instruments of all kinds were forbidden. My two hands, my two eyes, and the fish. It seemed a most limited field. I pushed my finger down its throat to feel how sharp the teeth were. I began to count the scales in the different rows until I was convinced that that was nonsense. At last a happy thought struck me. I would draw the fish. And now with surprise I began to discover new features in the creature. Just then the professor returned. "That is right," said he. "A pencil is one of the best of eyes. I am glad to notice, too, that you keep your specimen wet and your bottle corked." With these encouraging words he added, "Well, what is it like?" He listened attentively to my brief rehearsal of the structure of parts whose names were still unknown to me. When I had finished, he waited as if expecting more, and then, with an air of disappointment, "You have not looked very carefully." "Why?" he continued, more earnestly. "You haven't even seen one of the most conspicuous features of the animal, which is as plainly before your eyes as the fish itself. Look again, look again." And he left me to my misery. Now as I set myself to my task with a will, and discovered one new thing after another, until I saw how just the professor's criticism had been, the afternoon passed quickly, and when, toward its close, the professor inquired, "Do you see it yet?" "No," I replied, "I am certain I do not. But I see how little I saw before." "That is next best," said he earnestly, "but I won't hear you now. Put away your fish and go home. Perhaps you will be ready with a better answer in the morning. I will examine you before you look at the fish." The cordial greeting from the professor the next morning was reassuring. Here was a man who seemed to be quite as anxious as I, that I should see for myself what he saw. "Do you perhaps mean," I asked, "that the fish has symmetrical sides with paired organs?" He was thoroughly pleased. "Of course, of course." After he had discoursed most happily and enthusiastically, as he always did, upon the importance of this point, I ventured to ask what I should do next. "Oh, look at your fish," he said, and left me again to my own devices. In a little more than an hour, he returned and heard my new catalogue. "That is good, that is good," he repeated. "But that is not all. Go on." And so for 3 long days he placed that fish before my eyes, forbidding me to look at anything else or to use any artificial aid. "Look, look, look," was his repeated injunction. This was the best entomological lesson I ever had, a lesson whose influence has extended to the details of every subsequent study. A legacy the professor has left to me, as he left it to many others, of inestimable value, which he could not buy, with which he cannot part.